Never mind. They inhaled the spray mist from some kind of stain remover. Take me to my class, she said. Posture. When I pulled up in front of the church, some of her students were walking down the steps to the basement entrance. Babette looked at her son, a searching, pleading, and desperate look. He was in the sixth hour of his crying. She ran along the sidewalk and into the building. I thought of taking him to the hospital. But if a doctor who examined the boy thoroughly in his cozy office with paintings on the wall in elaborate gilded frames could find nothing wrong, then what could emergency technicians do, people trained to leap on chests and pound at static hearts? I picked him up and set him against the steering wheel, facing me, his feet on my thighs. The huge lament continued, wave on wave. It was a sound so large and pure I could almost listen to it, try consciously to apprehend it, as one sets up a mental register in a concert hall or theater. He was not sniveling or blubbering. He was crying out, saying nameless things in a way that touched me with its depth and richness. This was an ancient dirge all the more impressive for its resolute monotony. Ululation. I held him upright with a hand under each arm. As the crying continued, a curious shift developed in my thinking. I found that I did not necessarily wish him to stop. It might not be so terrible, I thought, to have to sit and listen to this a while longer. We looked at each other. Behind that dopey countenance, a complex intelligence operated. I held him with one hand, using the other to count his fingers inside the mittens, aloud, in German. The inconsolable crying went on. I let it wash over me, like rain in sheets. I entered it, in a sense. I let it fall and tumble across my face and chest. I began to think he had disappeared inside this wailing noise, and if I could join him in his lost and suspended place, we might together perform some reckless wonder of intelligibility. I let it break across my body. It might not be so terrible, I thought, to have to sit here for 4 more hours, with the motor running and the heater on, listening to this uniform lament. It might be good. It might be strangely soothing. I entered it, fell into it, letting it enfold and cover me. He cried with his eyes open, his eyes closed, his hands in his pockets, his mittens on and off. I sat there, nodding sagely. On an impulse, I turned him around, sat him on my lap, and started up the car, letting Wilder steer. We'd done this once before, for a distance of 20 yards, at Sunday dusk, in August, our street deep in drowsy shadow. Again he responded, crying as he steered, as we turned corners, as I brought the car to a halt back at the Congregational Church. I set him on my left leg, an arm around him, drawing him toward me, and let my mind drift toward near sleep. The sound moved into a fitful distance. Now and then a car went by. I leaned against the door, faintly aware of his breath on my thumb. Sometime later, Babette was knocking on the window, and Wilder was crawling across the seat to lift the latch for her. She got in, adjusted his hat, picked a crumpled tissue off the floor. We were halfway home when the crying stopped. It stopped suddenly, without a change in tone and intensity. Babette said nothing. I kept my eyes on the road. He sat between us, looking into the radio. I waited for Babette to glance at me behind his back, over his head, to show relief, happiness, hopeful suspense. I didn't know how I felt and wanted a clue. but she looked straight ahead as if fearful that any change in the sensitive texture of sound, movement, expression, would cause the crying to break out again. At the house no one spoke. They all moved quietly from room to room, watching him distantly, with sneaky and respectful looks. When he asked for some milk, Denise ran softly to the kitchen, barefoot, in her pajamas, sensing that by economy of movement and lightness of step, she might keep from disturbing the grave and dramatic air he had brought with him into the house. He drank the milk down in a single powerful swallow, still fully dressed, a mitten pinned to his sleeve. They watched him with something like awe. Nearly 7 straight hours of serious crying. It was as though he'd just returned from a period of wandering in some remote and holy place, in sand barrens or snowy ranges. A place where things are said, sights are seen, distances reached, which we, in our ordinary toil, can only regard with the mingled reverence and wonder we hold in reserve for feats of the most sublime and difficult dimensions. Chapter 17. Babette said to me in bed one night, "Isn't it great having all these kids around?" "There'll be one more soon."
"Who?"
"B is coming in a couple of days."
"Good. Who else can we get?"
The next day, Denise decided to confront her mother directly about the medication she was or was not taking, hoping to trick Babette into a confession, an admission, or some minimal kind of flustered response. This was not a tactic the girl and I had discussed, but I couldn't help admiring the boldness of her timing. All 6 of us were jammed into the car on our way to the Mid-Village Mall, and Denise simply waited for a natural break in the conversation, directing her question toward the back of Babette's head, in a voice drained of inference.
"What do you know about Dilar?"
"Is that the black girl who's staying with the Stovers?"
"That's Dakar," Steffi said.
"Dakar isn't her name, it's where she's from," Denise said. "It's a country on the Ivory Coast of Africa."
"The capital is Lagos," Babette said.
"I know that because of a surfer movie I saw once where they travel all over the world."
"The Perfect Wave," Heinrich said. "I saw it on TV."
"But what's the girl's name?" Steffi said.
"I don't know," Babette said, "but the movie wasn't called The Perfect Wave. The Perfect Wave is what they were looking for."
"They go to Hawaii," Denise told Steffi, "and wait for these tidal waves to come from Japan. They're called origamis."
"And the movie was called The Long Hot Summer," her mother said.
"The Long Hot Summer," Heinrich said, "happens to be a play by Tennessee Ernie Williams."
"It doesn't matter," Babette said, "because you can't copyright titles anyway."
"If she's an African," Steffi said, "I wonder if she ever rode a camel."
"Try an Audi Turbo."
"Try a Toyota Supra."
"What is it camels store in their humps?" Babette said. "Food or water? I never could get that straight."
"There are 1-hump camels and 2-hump camels," Heinrich told her, "so it depends which kind you're talking about."
"Are you telling me a 2-hump camel stores food in one hump and water in the other?"
"The important thing about camels," he said, "is that camel meat is considered a delicacy."
"I thought that was alligator meat," Denise said.
"Who introduced the camel to America?" Babette said.
"They had them out west for a while to carry supplies to coolies who were building the great railroads that met at Ogden, Utah. I remember my history exams."
"Are you sure you're not talking about llamas?" Heinrich said.
"The llama stayed in Peru," Denise said. "Peru has the llama, the vicuña, and 1 other animal. Bolivia has tin. Chile has copper and iron."
"I'll give anyone in this car $5, Heinrich said, "if they can name the population of Bolivia."
"Bolivians," my daughter said. The family is the cradle of the world's misinformation. There must be something in family life that generates factual error. Over-closeness, the noise and heat of being. Perhaps something even deeper, like the need to survive. Murray says we are fragile creatures surrounded by a world of hostile facts. Facts threaten our happiness and security. The deeper we delve into the nature of things, the looser our structure may seem to become. The family process works toward sealing off the world. Small errors grow heads. Fictions proliferate. I tell Murray that ignorance and confusion can't possibly be the driving forces behind family solidarity. What an idea! What a subversion! He asks me why the strongest family units exist in the least developed societies. Not to know is a weapon of survival, he says. Magic and superstition become entrenched as the powerful orthodoxy of the clan. The family is strongest where objective reality is most likely to be misinterpreted. What a heartless theory, I say. But Murray insists it's true. In a huge hardware store at the mall, I saw Eric Massengale, a former microchip sales engineer who changed his life by coming out here to join the teaching staff of the computer center at the Hill. He was slim and pale, with a dangerous grin. "You're not wearing dark glasses, Jack." "I only wear them on campus." "I get it." We went our separate ways into the store's deep interior. A great echoing din, as of the extinction of a species of beast, filled the vast space. People bought 22-foot ladders, 6 kinds of sandpaper, power saws that could fell trees. The aisles were long and bright, filled with oversized brooms, massive sacks of peat and dung, huge Rubbermaid garbage cans. Rope hung like tropical fruit, beautifully braided strands, thick, brown, strong. What a great thing a coil of rope is to look at and feel. I bought 50 feet of manila hemp just to have it around, show it to my son, talk about where it comes from, how it's made. People spoke English, Hindi, Vietnamese, related tongues. I ran into Massengale again at the cash terminals. "I've never seen you off campus, Jack. You look different without your glasses and gown. Where did you get that sweater? Is that a Turkish army sweater? Mail order, right?" He looked me over, felt the material of the water-repellent jacket I was carrying draped across my arm. Then he backed up, altering his perspective, nodding a little, his grin beginning to take on a self-satisfied look, reflecting some inner calculation. "I think I know those shoes," he said. What did he mean, he knew these shoes? "You're a different person altogether." "Different in what way, Eric?" "You won't take offense," he said, the grin turning lascivious, rich with secret meaning. "Of course not. Why would I?" "Promise you won't take offense." "I won't take offense." "You look so harmless, Jack. A big, harmless, aging, indistinct sort of guy." "Why would I take offense?" I said, paying for my rope and hurrying out the door. The encounter put me in the mood to shop. I found the others, and we walked across 2 parking lots to the main structure in the Mid-Village Mall. A 10-story building arranged around a center court of waterfalls, promenades, and gardens. Babette and the kids followed me into the elevator, into the shops set along the tiers, through the emporiums and department stores, puzzled but excited by my desire to buy. When I could not decide between 2 shirts, they encouraged me to buy both. When I said I was hungry, they fed me pretzels, beer, souvlaki. The 2 girls scouted ahead, spotting things they thought I might want or need, running back to get me, to clutch my arms, plead with me to follow. They were my guides to endless well-being. People swarmed through the boutiques and gourmet shops. Organ music rose from the great court. We smelled chocolate, popcorn, cologne. We smelled rugs and furs, hanging salamis and deathly vinyl. My family gloried in the event. I was one of them, shopping at last. They gave me advice, badgered clerks on my behalf. I kept seeing myself unexpectedly in some reflecting surface. We moved from store to store, rejecting not only items in certain departments, not only entire departments, but whole stores, mammoth corporations that did not strike our fancy for one reason or another. There was always another store, 3 floors, 8 floors, basement full of cheese graters and paring knives. I shopped with reckless abandon. I shopped for immediate needs and distant contingencies. I shopped for its own sake, looking and touching, inspecting merchandise I had no intention of buying, then buying it. I sent clerks into their fabric books and pattern books to search for elusive designs. I began to grow in value and self-regard. I filled myself out, found new aspects of myself, located a person I'd forgotten existed. Brightness settled around me. We crossed from furniture to menswear, walking through cosmetics. Our images appeared on mirrored columns, in glassware and chrome, on TV monitors in security rooms. I traded money for goods. The more money I spent, the less important it seemed. I was bigger than these sums. These sums poured off my skin like so much rain. These sums, in fact, came back to me in the form of existential credit. I felt expansive, inclined to be sweepingly generous, and told the kids to pick out their Christmas gifts here and now. I gestured in what I felt was an expansive manner. I could tell they were impressed. They fanned out across the area, each of them suddenly inclined to be private, shadowy, even secretive. Periodically, one of them would return to register the name of an item with Babette, careful not to let the others know what it was. I myself was not to be bothered with tedious details. I was the benefactor, the one who disperses gifts, bonuses, bribes, bakshish. The children knew it was the nature of such things that I could not be expected to engage in technical discussions about the gifts themselves. We ate another meal. A band played live muzak. Voices rose 10 stories from the garden and promenades, a roar that echoed and swirled through the vast gallery, mixing with noises from the tiers, with shuffling feet and chiming bells, the hum of escalators, the sound of people eating, the human buzz of some vivid and happy transaction. We drove home in silence. We went to our respective rooms, wishing to be alone. A little later, I watched Steffi in front of the TV set. She moved her lips, attempting to match the words as they were spoken. Chapter 18. It is the nature and pleasure of townspeople to distrust the city. All the guiding principles that might flow from a center of ideas and cultural energies are regarded as corrupt, one or another kind of pornography. This is how it is with towns. But Blacksmith is nowhere near a large city. We don't feel threatened and aggrieved in quite the same way other towns do. We're not smack in the path of history and its contaminations. If our complaints have a focal point, it would have to be the TV set, where the outer torment lurks, causing fears and secret desires. Certainly, little or no resentment attaches to the college on the hill as an emblem of ruinous influence. The school occupies an ever-serene edge of the townscape, semi-detached, more or less scenic, suspended in political calm. Not a place designed to aggravate suspicions. In light snow, I drove to the airport outside Iron City. A large town sunk in confusion, a center of abandonment and broken glass, rather than a place of fully realized urban decay. B, my 12-year-old, was due in on a flight from Washington, with two stops and one change of planes along the way. But it was her mother, Tweedy Browner, who showed up in the arrivals area, a small, dusty, third-world place in a state of halted renovation. For a moment I thought B was dead, and Tweedy had come to tell me in person.
Where is B?
She's flying in later today. That's why I'm here, to spend some time with her. I have to go to Boston tomorrow. Family business.
But where is she?
With her father.
I'm her father, Tweedy.
Malcolm Hunt, stupid. My husband.
He's your husband. He's not her father.
Do you still love me, Tuck? She said. She called me Tuck, which is what her mother used to call her father. All the male Browners were called Tuck. When the line began to pale, producing a series of aesthetes and incompetence, they gave the name to any man who married into the family, within reason. I was the first of these, and kept expecting to hear a note of over-refined irony in their voices when they called me by that name. I thought that when tradition becomes too flexible, irony enters the voice. Nasality, sarcasm, self-caricature, and so on. They would punish me by mocking themselves. But they were sweet about it, entirely sincere, even grateful to me for allowing them to carry on. She wore a Shetland sweater, tweed skirt, knee socks, and penny loafers. There was a sense of Protestant disrepair about her, a collapsed aura in which her body struggled to survive. The fair and angular face, the slightly bulging eyes, the signs of strain and complaint that showed about the mouth and around the eyes, the pulsing at the temple, the raised veins in the hands and neck. Cigarette ash clung to the loose weave of her sweater.
For the third time, where is she?
Indonesia, more or less. Malcolm's working in deep cover, sponsoring a communist revival. It's part of an elegant scheme designed to topple Castro. Let's get out of here, Tuck, before children come swarming around to beg.
Is she coming alone?
Why wouldn't she be?
From the Far East to Iron City can't be that simple.
B can cope when she has to. She wants to be a travel writer, as a matter of actual fact. Sits a horse well. She took a deep drag on her cigarette and exhaled smoke in rapid expert streams from nose and mouth, a routine she used when she wanted to express impatience with her immediate surroundings. There were no bars or restaurants at the airport, just a stand with prepackaged sandwiches, presided over by a man with sect marks on his face. We got Tweedy's luggage, went out to the car, and drove through Iron City, past deserted factories, on mainly deserted avenues, a city of hills, occasional cobbled streets, fine old homes here and there, holiday wreaths in the windows.
Tuck, I'm not happy.
Why not?
I thought you'd love me forever, frankly. I depend on you for that. Malcolm's away so much.
We get a divorce, you take all my money, you marry a well-to-do, well-connected, well-tailored diplomat who secretly runs agents in and out of sensitive and inaccessible areas.
Malcolm has always been drawn to jungly places.
We were traveling parallel to railroad tracks, The weeds were full of styrofoam cups, tossed from train windows or wind-blown north from the depot.
"Janet has been drawn to Montana, to an ashram," I said.
"Janet Savory? Good God, whatever for?"
"Her name is Mother Devi now. She operates the ashram's business activities, investments, real estate, tax shelters. It's what Janet has always wanted, peace of mind in a profit-oriented context."
"Marvelous bone structure, Janet."
"She had a talent for stealth."
"You say that with such bitterness. I've never known you to be bitter, Tuck."
"Stupid, but not bitter."
"What do you mean by stealth?"
"Was she covert, like Malcolm?"
"She wouldn't tell me how much money she made. I think she used to read my mail. Right after Heinrich was born, she got me involved in a complex investment scheme with a bunch of multilingual people. She said she had information."
"But she was wrong, and you lost vast sums."
"We made vast sums. I was entangled, enmeshed. She was always maneuvering. My security was threatened. My sense of a long and eventful life. She wanted to incorporate us. We got phone calls from Liechtenstein, the Hebrides. Fictional places, plot devices."
"That doesn't sound like the Janet Savory I spent a delightful half hour with. The Janet with the high cheekbones and wry voice."
"You all had high cheekbones, every one of you. Marvelous bone structure. Thank God for Babette and her long, fleshy face."
"Isn't there somewhere we can get a civilized meal?" Tweedy said. "A tablecloth-y place with icy pats of butter. Malcolm and I once took tea with Colonel Gaddafi. A charming and ruthless man, one of the few terrorists we've met who lives up to his public billing."
The snow had stopped falling. We drove through a warehouse district, more deserted streets, a bleakness and anonymity that registered in the mind as a ghostly longing for something that was far beyond retrieval. There were lonely cafes, another stretch of track, freight cars paused at a siding. Tweedy chain-smoked extra longs, shooting exasperated streams of smoke in every direction.
"God, Tuck, we were good together."
"Good at what?"
"Fool, you're supposed to look at me in a fond and nostalgic way, smiling ruefully."
"You wore gloves to bed."
"I still do."
"Gloves, eye shades, and socks."
"You know my flaws. You always did. I'm ultra-sensitive to many things. Sunlight, air, food, water. Sex. Carcinogenic, every one of them."
"What's the family business in Boston all about?"
"I have to reassure my mother that Malcolm isn't dead. She's taken quite a shine to him for whatever reason."
"Why does she think he's dead?"
"When Malcolm goes into deep cover, it's as though he never existed. He disappears not only here and now, but retroactively. No trace of the man remains. I sometimes wonder if the man I'm married to is in fact Malcolm Hunt, or a completely different person who is himself operating under deep cover. It's frankly worrisome. I don't know which half of Malcolm's life is real, which half is intelligence. I'm hoping B can shed some light."
Traffic lights swayed on cables in a sudden gust. This was the city's main street, a series of discount stores, check-cashing places, wholesale outlets. A tall old Moorish movie theater, now remarkably a mosque. Blank structures called the Terminal Building, the Packer Building, the Commerce Building. How close this was to a classic photography of regret.
"A gray day in Iron City," I said. "We may as well go back to the airport."
"How is Hitler?"
"Fine. Solid. Dependable."
"You look good, Tuck."
"I don't feel good."
"You never felt good. You're the old Tuck. You were always the old Tuck.
We loved each other, didn't we? We told each other everything, within the limits of one's preoccupation with breeding and tact. Malcolm tells me nothing. Who is he? What does he do?
She sat with her legs tucked under her, facing me, and flicked ashes into her shoes, which sat on the rubber mat.
Wasn't it marvelous to grow up tall and straight, among geldings and mares, with a daddy who wore blue blazers and crisp gray flannels?
Don't ask me.
Mother used to stand in the arbor with an armful of cut flowers, just stand there, being what she was. At the airport we waited in a mist of plaster dust, among exposed wires, mounds of rubble. Half an hour before B was due to arrive, the passengers from another flight began filing through a drafty tunnel into the arrivals area. They were gray and stricken. They were stooped over in weariness and shock, dragging their hand luggage across the floor. 20, 30, 40 people came out, without a word or look, keeping their eyes to the ground. Some limped, some wept. More came through the tunnel, adults with whimpering children, old people trembling. A black minister with his collar askew, one shoe missing. Tweedy helped a woman with two small kids. I approached a young man, a stocky fellow with a mailman's cap and beer belly, wearing a down vest. And he looked at me as if I didn't belong in his space-time dimension, but had crossed over illegally. Made a rude incursion. I forced him to stop and face me. Asked him what had happened up there. As people kept filing past, he exhaled wearily. Then he nodded, his eyes steady on mine, full of a gentle resignation. The plane had lost power in all three engines, dropped from 34,000 feet to 12,000 feet, something like 4 miles. When the steep glide began, people rose, fell, collided, swam in their seats. Then the serious screaming and moaning began. Almost immediately a voice from the flight deck was heard on the intercom. "We're falling out of the sky. We're going down. We're a silver gleaming death machine." This outburst struck the passengers as an all but total breakdown of authority, competence, and command presence, and it brought on a round of fresh and desperate wailing. Objects were rolling out of the galley. The aisles were full of drinking glasses, utensils, coats, and blankets. A stewardess, pinned to the bulkhead by the sharp angle of descent, was trying to find the relevant passage in a handbook titled Manual of Disasters. Then there was a second male voice from the flight deck, this one remarkably calm and precise, making the passengers believe there was someone in charge after all, an element of hope. "This is American 213 to the cockpit voice recorder. Now we know what it's like. It is worse than we'd ever imagined. They didn't prepare us for this at the death simulator in Denver. Our fear is pure, so totally stripped of distractions and pressures as to be a form of transcendental meditation. In less than 3 minutes we will touch down, so to speak. They will find our bodies in some smoking field, strewn about in the grisly attitudes of death. I love you, Lance." This time there was a brief pause before the mass wailing recommenced. "Lance? What kind of people were in control of this aircraft?" The crying took on a bitter and disillusioned tone. As the man in the down vest told the story, passengers from the tunnel began gathering around us. No one spoke, interrupted, tried to embellish the account. Aboard the gliding craft, a stewardess crawled down the aisle over bodies and debris, telling people in each row to remove their shoes, remove sharp objects from their pockets, assume a fetal position. At the other end of the plane, someone was wrestling with a flotation device. Certain elements in the crew had decided to pretend that it was not a crash,
but a crash landing that was seconds away. After all, the difference between the two is only one word. Didn't this suggest that the two forms of flight termination were more or less interchangeable? How much could one word matter? An encouraging question under the circumstances, if you didn't think about it too long. And there was no time to think right now. The basic difference between a crash and a crash landing seemed to be that you could sensibly prepare for a crash landing, which is exactly what they were trying to do. The news spread through the plane. The term was repeated in row after row. Crash landing, crash landing. They saw how easy it was, by adding one word, to maintain a grip on the future, to extend it in consciousness, if not in actual fact. They patted themselves for ballpoint pens, went fetal in their seats. By the time the narrator reached this point in his account, many people were crowded around, not only people who'd just emerged from the tunnel, but also those who'd been among the first to disembark. They'd come back to listen. They were not yet ready to disperse, to re-inhabit their earthbound bodies, but wanted to linger with their terror, keep it separate and intact for just a while longer. More people drifted toward us, milled about, close to the entire plane load. They were content to let the capped and vested man speak on their behalf. No one disputed his account or tried to add individual testimony. It was as though they were being told of an event they hadn't personally been involved in. They were interested in what he said, even curious, but also clearly detached. They trusted him to tell them what they'd said and felt. It was at this point in the descent, as the term crash landing spread through the plane, with a pronounced vocal stress on the second word, that passengers in first class came scrambling and clawing through the curtains, literally climbing their way into the tourist section in order to avoid being the first to strike the ground. There were those in tourist who felt they ought to be made to go back. This sentiment was expressed not so much in words and actions as in terrible and inarticulate sounds, mainly cattle noises, an urgent and force-fed lowing. Suddenly the engines restarted. Just like that. Power, stability, control. The passengers, prepared for impact, were slow to adjust to the new wave of information. New sounds, a different flight path, a sense of being encased in solid tubing and not some polyurethane wrap. The smoking sign went on, an international hand with a cigarette. Stewardesses appeared with scented towelettes for cleaning blood and vomit. People slowly came out of their fetal positions, sat back limply. 4 miles of prime-time terror. No one knew what to say. Being alive was a richness of sensation. Dozens of things, hundreds of things. The first officer walked down the aisle, smiling and chatting in an empty, pleasant, corporate way. His face had the rosy and confident polish that is familiar in handlers of large passenger aircraft. They looked at him and wondered why they'd been afraid. I'd been pushed away from the narrator by people crowding in to listen, well over 100 of them, dragging their shoulder bags and garment bags across the dusty floor. Just as I realized I was almost out of hearing range, I saw B standing next to me, her small face smooth and white in a mass of kinky hair. She jumped up into my embrace, smelling of jet exhaust. "Where's the media?" she said. "There is no media in Iron City." "They went through all that for nothing?" We found Tweedy and headed out to the car. There was a traffic jam on the outskirts of the city, and we had to sit on a road outside an abandoned foundry. 1,000 broken windows, streetlights broken, darkness settling in. B sat in the middle of the rear seat in the lotus position. She seemed remarkably well-rested after a journey that had spanned time zones, land masses, vast oceanic distances, days and nights, on large and small planes, in summer and winter, from Surabaya to Iron City. Now we sat waiting in the dark for a car to get towed or a drawbridge to close. B didn't think this familiar irony of modern travel was worth a comment. She just sat there listening to Tweedy explain to me why parents needn't worry about children taking such trips alone. Planes and terminals are the safest of places for the very young and the very old. They are looked after, smiled upon, admired for their resourcefulness and pluck. People ask friendly questions, offer them blankets and sweets.
"Every child ought to have the opportunity to travel thousands of miles alone," Tweedy said, "for the sake of her self-esteem and independence of mind, with clothes and toiletries of her own choosing. The sooner we get them in the air, the better. Like swimming or ice skating. You have to start them young. It's one of the things I'm proudest to have accomplished with B. I sent her to Boston on Eastern when she was 9. I told Granny Browner not to meet her plane. Getting out of airports is every bit as important as the actual flight. Too many parents ignore this phase of a child's development. B is thoroughly bicoastal now. She flew her first jumbo at 10, changed planes at O'Hare, had a near miss in Los Angeles. 2 weeks later, she took the Concorde to London. Malcolm was waiting with a split of champagne. Up ahead, the taillights danced. The line began to move. Barring mechanical failures, turbulent weather, and terrorist acts, Tweedy said, an aircraft traveling at the speed of sound may be the last refuge of gracious living and civilized manners known to man.
Chapter 19 B made us feel self-conscious at times, a punishment that visitors will unintentionally inflict on their complacent hosts. Her presence seemed to radiate a surgical light. We began to see ourselves as a group that acted without design, avoided making decisions, took turns being stupid and emotionally unstable, left wet towels everywhere, mislaid our youngest member. Whatever we did was suddenly a thing that seemed to need explaining. My wife was especially disconcerted. If Denise was a pint-sized commissar nagging us to higher conscience, then B was a silent witness, calling the very meaning of our lives into question. I watched Babette stare into her cupped hands, aghast. That chirping sound was just the radiator. B was quietly disdainful of wisecracks, sarcasm, and other family business. A year older than Denise, she was taller, thinner, paler, both worldly and ethereal, as though in her heart she was not a travel writer at all, as her mother had said she wished to be, but simply a traveler, the purer form, someone who collects impressions, dense anatomies of feeling, but does not care to record them. She was self-possessed and thoughtful, had brought us hand-carved gifts from the jungles. She took taxis to school and dance class, spoke a little Chinese, had once wired money to a stranded friend. I admired her in a distant and uneasy way, sensing a nameless threat, as if she were not my child at all, but the sophisticated and self-reliant friend of one of my children. Was Murray right? Were we a fragile unit surrounded by hostile facts? Would I promote ignorance, prejudice, and superstition to protect my family from the world? On Christmas Day, B sat by the fireplace in our seldom-used living room, watching the turquoise flames. She wore a long, loose khaki outfit that looked casually expensive. I sat in the armchair with three or four gift boxes in my lap, apparel and tissue paper hanging out. My dog-eared copy of Mein Kampf rested on the floor at the side of the chair. Some of the other people were in the kitchen preparing the meal. Some had gone upstairs to investigate their gifts in private. The TV said, "This creature has developed a complicated stomach in keeping with its leafy diet."
"I don't like this business with Mother," B said in a voice of cultivated distress. "She looks keyed up all the time, like she's worried about something, but she's not sure what it is." "It's Malcolm, of course. He's got his jungle. What does she have?" "A huge, airy kitchen with a stove that belongs in a 3-star restaurant in the provinces. She put all her energy into that kitchen, but for what? It's not a kitchen at all. It's her life, her middle age. Baba could enjoy a kitchen like that. It would be a kitchen to her. To Mother, it's like a weird symbol of getting through a crisis. Except she hasn't gotten through it."
"Your mother is not sure exactly who her husband is."
"That's not the basic problem. The basic problem is that she doesn't know who she is. Malcolm is in the highlands living on tree bark and snake. That's who Malcolm is. He needs heat and humidity. He's got like how many degrees in foreign affairs and economics, but all he wants to do is squat under a tree and watch tribal people pack mud all over their bodies. They're fun to watch. What does Mother do for fun?"
B was small-featured except for her eyes, which seemed to contain two forms of life, the subject matter and its hidden implications. She talked about Babette's effortless skills in making things work, the house, the kids, the flow of the routine universe, sounding a little like me. But there was a secondary sea life moving deep in the iris of her eye. What did it mean? What was she really saying? Why did she seem to expect me to respond in kind? She wanted to communicate in this secondary way with optic fluids. She would have her suspicions confirmed. Find out about me. But what suspicions did she harbor? And what was there to find out? I began to worry. As the odor of burning toast filled the house, I tried to get her to talk about life in the 7th grade.
"Is the kitchen on fire?"
"That's Steffi burning toast, a thing she does from time to time."
"I could have prepared some kind of kimchi dish."
"Something from your Korean period."
"It's cabbage pickled with red pepper and a bunch of other things. Fiery hot. But I don't know about ingredients. They're hard enough to find in Washington."
"We're probably having something besides toast," I said. The mild rebuke made her happy. She liked me best when I was dry, derisive, and cutting. A natural talent she believed I'd forfeited through long association with children. The TV said, "Now we will put the little feelers on the butterfly." In bed, 2 nights later, I heard voices, put on my robe, and went down the hall to see what was going on. Denise stood outside the bathroom door.
"Steffi's taking one of her baths."
"It's late," I said.
"She's just sitting in all that dirty water."
"It's my dirt," Steffi said from the other side of the door.
"It's still dirt."
"Well, it's my dirt, and I don't care." "It's dirt," Denise said.
"It's my dirt."
"Dirt is dirt. Not when it's mine." B appeared at the end of the hall wearing a silver and red kimono. Just stood there, distant and pale. There was a moment in which our locus of pettiness and shame seemed palpably to expand, a cartoon of self-awareness. Denise muttered something violent to Steffi through the crack in the door,
then went quietly to her room. In the morning I drove B to the airport. Rides to airports make me quiet and glum. We listened to news updates on the radio, curiously excited reports about firemen removing a burning sofa from a tenement in Watertown, delivered in a background clamor of ticker tape machines. I realized B was watching me carefully, importantly. She sat with her back against the door, her knees up, held tightly together, arms enfolding them. The look was one of solemn compassion. It was a look I did not necessarily trust, believing it had little to do with pity or love or sadness. I recognized it, in fact, as something else completely, the adolescent female's tenderest form of condescension. On the way back from the airport, I got off the expressway at the River Road and parked the car at the edge of the woods. I walked up a steep path. There was an old picket fence with a sign. The Old Burying Ground, Blacksmith Village. The headstones were small, tilted, pockmarked, spotted with fungus or moss, the names and dates barely legible. The ground was hard with patches of ice. I walked among the stones, taking off my gloves to touch the rough marble. Embedded in the dirt before one of the markers was a narrow vase containing three small American flags, the only sign that someone had preceded me to this place in this century. I was able to make out some of the names, great, strong, simple names, suggesting a moral rigor. I stood and listened. I was beyond the traffic noise, the intermittent stir of factories across the river. So at least in this they'd been correct, placing the graveyard here, a silence that had stood its ground. The air had a bite. I breathed deeply, remained in one spot, waiting to feel the peace that is supposed to descend upon the dead, waiting to see the light that hangs above the fields of the landscapist's lament. I stood there listening. The wind blew smoke from the branches. Snow blew out of the woods in eddies and sweeping gusts. I raised my collar, put my gloves back on. When the air was still again, I walked among the stones, trying to read the names and dates, adjusting the flags to make them swing free. Then I stood and listened. The power of the dead is that we think they see us all the time. The dead have a presence. Is there a level of energy composed solely of the dead? They are also in the ground, of course, asleep and crumbling. Perhaps we are what they dream. May the days be aimless. Let the seasons drift. Do not advance the action according to a plan. Chapter 20. Mr. Treadwell's sister died. Her first name was Gladys. The doctor said she died of lingering dread, a result of the 4 days and nights she and her brother had spent in the Mid-Village Mall, lost and confused. A man in Glassboro died when the rear wheel of his car separated from the axle, an idiosyncrasy of that particular model. The lieutenant governor of the state died of undisclosed natural causes after a long illness. We all know what that means. A Mechanicsville man died outside Tokyo during a siege of the airport by 10,000 helmeted students. When I read obituaries, I always note the age of the deceased. Automatically, I relate this figure to my own age. 4 years to go, I think. 9 more years. 2 years, and I'm dead. The power of numbers is never more evident than when we use them to speculate on the time of our dying. Sometimes I bargain with myself. Would I be willing to accept 65? Genghis Khan's age on dying? Suleiman the Magnificent made it to 76.
That sounds all right, especially the way I feel now. But how will it sound when I'm 73? It's hard to imagine these men feeling sad about death. Attila the Hun died young. He was still in his 40s. Did he feel sorry for himself, succumb to self-pity and depression? He was the king of the Huns, the invader of Europe, the scourge of God. I want to believe he lay in his tent, wrapped in animal skins, as in some internationally financed movie epic, and said brave, cruel things to his aides and retainers. No weakening of the spirit, no sense of the irony of human existence, that we are the highest form of life on earth and yet ineffably sad because we know what no other animal knows, that we must die. Attila did not look through the opening in his tent and gesture at some lame dog standing at the edge of the fire waiting to be thrown a scrap of meat. He did not say, "That pathetic, flea-ridden beast is better off than the greatest ruler of men. It doesn't know what we know. It doesn't feel what we feel. It can't be sad as we are sad." I want to believe he was not afraid. He accepted death as an experience that flows naturally from life. A wild ride through the forest, as would befit someone known as the Scourge of God. This is how it ended for him, with his attendants cutting off their hair and disfiguring their own faces in barbarian tribute. As the camera pulls back out of the tent and pans across the night sky of the 5th century A.D., clear and uncontaminated, bright banded with shimmering worlds. Babette looked up from her eggs and hash browns and said to me with a quiet intensity, "Life is good, Jack."
"What brings this on?"
"I just think it ought to be said."
"Do you feel better now that you've said it?"
"I have terrible dreams," she murmured.
"Who will die first?"
"She says she wants to die first because she would feel unbearably lonely and sad without me, especially if the children were grown and living elsewhere. She is adamant about this. She sincerely wants to precede me. She discusses the subject with such argumentative force that it's obvious she thinks we have a choice in the matter. She also thinks nothing can happen to us as long as there are dependent children in the house. The kids are a guarantee of our relative longevity. We're safe as long as they're around. But once they get big and scatter, she wants to be the first to go. She sounds almost eager. She is afraid I will die unexpectedly, sneakily, slipping away in the night. It isn't that she doesn't cherish life. It's being left alone that frightens her. The emptiness, the sense of cosmic darkness. MasterCard, Visa, American Express. I tell her I want to die first. I've gotten so used to her that I would feel miserably incomplete. We are two views of the same person. I would spend the rest of my life turning to speak to her. No one there. A hole in space and time. She claims my death would leave a bigger hole in her life than her death would leave in mine. This is the level of our discourse. The relative size of holes, abysses, and gaps. We have serious arguments on this level. She says if her death is capable of leaving a large hole in my life, my death would leave an abyss in hers, a great yawning gulf. I counter with a profound depth or void. And so it goes into the night. These arguments never seem foolish at the time. Such is the dignifying power of our subject. She put on a long, glossy, padded coat. It looked segmented, exoskeletal, designed for the ocean floor, and went out to teach her class in posture. Steffi moved soundlessly through the house, carrying small plastic bags she used for lining the wicker baskets scattered about. She did this once or twice a week with the quiet and conscientious air of someone who does not want credit for saving lives. Murray came over to talk to the two girls and Wilder, something he did from time to time as part of his investigation into what he called the Society of Kids. He talked about the otherworldly babble of the American family.